Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. American Theater Company presents My Big Gay Italian Wedding tonight through Sunday this week and again next weekend at the ATC Studios at 308 South Lansing Place. When playwright Anthony Wilkinson first wrote this comedy back in 2002 with a title inspired by the then new film My Big Fat Greek Wedding, marriage equality was just a dream and prohibited in all 50 states. He had a couple of years of running the show in New York, but closed it down. But by the time he revived the show back in 2009, the first state had legalized same-sex marriage, and debate was fierce. And as a result, audiences have flocked to the show ever since. The show has been playing in New York ever since. And has spawned two spinoffs, My Big Gay Italian Funeral and My Big Gay Italian Midlife Crisis, which will begin New York previews in the fall. Wilkinson is in town for the opening of the show from American Theater Company this weekend, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Anthony Wilkinson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take us back to 2002.
Yep.
When actually that film, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, came about. How did you get the idea for the gay Italian wedding?
Well, I know the title is obviously derived from people more know, which is My Big Fat Greek Wedding, but I had not even seen the film, but I loved the idea. I was very familiar with Tony and Tina's Wedding, which was right. An off-Broadway sensation. And the fantasy came to me that how cool would it be if I could get married? And I had just fallen in love for the first time with my partner at the time. And it was just the novelty of it all in the beginning. And it was really interesting. And I always wrote comedy, except for when I worked for a soap opera. But I loved to do comedy and perform comedy. I had written other shows before this. And I came up with My Big Gay Italian Wedding. And when I first opened in 2003, it was it did well for a year in the Village, but I don't think it was ripe yet. And it was certainly not legal in any state. I remember in 2004 it passed in Massachusetts, and it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And then I went and did a couple other shows, and then in 2009 I brought it back full force. So we did close it for a little while, and then in 2009 we brought it back, and that's when it opened on Broadway in the Broadway District, which is amazing. So, yeah.
And I think at that point it was people were ready to see a show like this.
Absolutely.
And talk about that.
Yeah, it wasn't allowed in the district back in 2003.
They wouldn't allow it in the district?
No, they had issues with the gay wedding thing in a title on a marquee in the Broadway District. It's like they didn't want to see. They were, especially that Times Square is so – you have kids.
Family oriented.
Exactly. Yeah. They were very concerned about
Disney-fied,
that.
Disneyfied.
Exactly. Exactly. So now.
That blows my mind.
Yeah, very true story.
2003, you couldn't put My Big Gay Italian Wedding on
no,
a marquee.
Theaters were not happy with that. They were afraid of defacing property and people who would react and retaliate.
We're talking in the theater district.
We're talking in the theater district. The gayest place in the world. But I think they were more concerned about the people, the tourists. So it took a while, but we got there, never thinking it was actually going to be legal in the country. I still am baffled by that. I remember when it became legal in New York and we were performing that night. And I came out and we said a curtain call. It just got passed in New York and everybody was like roaring. It was crazy. And then now this, it's like amazing.
And here you are in Tulsa, Oklahoma doing this show.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah. No, it is very cool. And take us back to 2009 and 2010 mm-hmm. when New York is passing marriage equality laws. Process of doing this.
Sure.
What were the audiences like? Were there ever debates?
Well,
out in the audience?
I mean, the thing about my show is it's very funny.
Yeah, it's a comedy,
it's a spoof. And I don't think people came with the intention of getting into politics. And I always found it to be a problem when a lot of these artists or would make it, because I was like, you know, there's certain things you just don't want to discuss with other people. I don't want to discuss politics. And even though I did have a very, very strong view, obviously, I didn't want to throw it in anybody's face. So my ticket to you was, let me entertain you. Let me bring you in for a great night of theater where you can laugh out loud, have a good time. It's a laugh out loud comedy. And then just maybe you leave with a subtle hint of thinking, just a little bit differently. And that's what I try to reach. And that's what was a lot of the reactions back when it first opened in 09-10, because I did a lot of revisions before we opened in that area. And that was a lot of the feedback we were getting. And what was great was it became almost like the Rocky Horror of New York. I was having people that were coming 10, 15, 20 times, and they were bringing groups. So it became contagious, because there is a little bit of an interactive element sometimes, just a little bit, but enough that the audience was really getting a kick out of it. So they started coming, and it was really – and my main audience really was women. It wasn't the gays. The gays still – you know, they come, but they come in drips and drips. You can't count on them. The women were my audience. I mean, I had – hundreds, I mean, of women that would really like advocates for the show. And then I think what they did was they started bringing their straight boyfriends who had no choice but to go. And then they started to think a little differently. But I did get a lot of mail, which was always a nice compliment. It was one thing if people liked the show and they laughed and had a good time. But whenever somebody would say to me, you know, I'm glad I saw this. I think, you know, this really made me think a little bit differently. That was always refreshing. That was really kind of cool to hear sometimes. Now,
your show is kind of like Tony and Tina's Wedding, which is...
Tony and Tina's very interactive.
It's very interactive.
Yeah.
But what do you suppose is really appealing about that type of show?
Well, I think it plays on the stereotype of Italian-Americans. Yeah. And I always believed as a good comedian that if you can't make fun of yourself, you can't make fun of anyone else. Mm-hmm. So I found all the things as well. And there is a character, my character, Anthony Pununziato. I mean, that's not my name, but it's me. And the main thing I do is make fun of myself on stage. So, and then I, of course, make fun of my mother and my aunts. And people love that. And they like to make fun of, you know, so I could do that. And I notice it's even catchy with a lot of reality shows today, how for some reason America is very fixated on, you know, Real Housewives of New Jersey and Jersey Shore and all those kind of reality shows that play off of Italian stereotypes.
Right, right. As well as the idea of this wedding thing where you have all these shows having to do with weddings,
mm-hmm,
too.
Absolutely.
I don't know why that is a thing.
Well, I don't know either, but I do think that the, as far as the Italian thing goes, I mean, well, first of all, it's a lot of people who speak like me, which is unique. especially here. Everybody's like, you have an accent. I'm like, no, you have an accent. It was so funny to hear my show last night without an accent. It was really kind of cool. I think the wedding thing is catchy. Now, especially that the gay marriage is legal in the country. I mean, I think it'll be very good for the economy as well.
Now, you mentioned women are your main audience.
Number one.
Yeah. What do you suppose appeals to them about this particular show?
I think because they connect with it. They do connect with it. Women love the idea. I mean, it's the planning of a wedding.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
The planning of the wedding and all the, you know, the drama and the fun stuff. Women in general over the course of time have always had, I mean, like, it's always like the ongoing joke that every girl has a gay best friend, you know? Mm-hmm. And as a gay man, I can say that coming out, I did initially have all female friends. It's just where we gravitate towards. So, women have always, I think, found a closeness with gay men, and they feel comfortable with them. It's like having a man in your life who doesn't necessarily going to want to pursue you for sex.
Yeah.
So, and I have a lot of great girlfriends. So I think that's part of the appeal. They come, I get hair salons and all kinds of bridal parties, bachelorette parties. It's really a lot of fun.
And it really has become a sort of a social event in New York.
Totally. Yeah.
I mean, and you're going on, what is this, the fifth or sixth straight year of doing shows on and off in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, now it's going internationally. You had a Hong Kong.
A Hong Kong opening. I didn't go to that one, but I did see it in France.
What was it? What's it like to see this piece done in France or England and UK?
I would like to go. Well, it's going to open. I just got an email yesterday that it's going to open in London and like in a bigger venue in Greenwich, which is
amazing. You
did
the Fringe Festival.
They did it. Mm-hmm. Someone licensed it up there. I didn't see that production. I did go to the opening of the UK tour, which was in a part of France, it escapes me right now, but it was northern France, like right on the water.
Right.
And it was, we flew into Paris, and then it was like a 2-hour train ride. It was surreal. It was surreal, to say the least. I would say right now, probably one of the best moments of my life, just to sit there in a flight. I'd never been to Europe ever. And that was because I had a fear of flying. So I finally got over my fear. That's why I didn't go to the original one in Edinburgh. Uh-huh. But I said, I have to, this is too big. And it was this beautiful, beautiful 1,000-seat theater. And I sat there right in the fifth row. It was packed. And everybody was speaking French behind me. And I was like, this is so cool. And like when they made the announcement, it was like, je ne peux pas. I was like, oh my God, they're speaking French. This is so weird. And then to see like the characters come to life, I said, you know, they were asking me at the theater in Tulsa. And I said, because I think the characters were all so nervous, the actors and the, mm-hmm. for what reason? I understand and I appreciate that. But at the same point, there's nothing to be nervous about. Because to me, it's like watching my child who can do no wrong. You know, it's like I just sat there like, yay, and I'm clapping it. Like, you know, I was elated to see that. So it was really a nice experience.
Yeah. And was it in English or was it in French?
Both.
Both. Yeah. Yeah. I think that would be really weird to see your work translated into a different language.
Yeah.
Has that happened yet?
Well, that's actually in progress. In progress.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. There's one deal that I've heard about. That's in the pipeline right now. They're in I can't say out loud, obviously, but yeah. There is a country that wants the rights, so that would be cool.
Now, 1,000-seat theater, this doesn't strike me as a 1,000-seat theater sort of piece.
You know, it works. And when we did the original showcase back in 09,
I would imagine
it
was like a couple
I actually did it at a 2,000-seat theater.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. But to run on a continuous basis, the theater here in Tulsa is a little more accurate to what we have in New York. It's, you know, it plays really well for like a 100 to 200 seat theater because then you really can feel the intimacy of the play. And I think people, you just feel more like you're actually at the wedding. Tulsa did that beautifully, I have to say. It was a very unique staging because she has you going, which we don't do, or nor have I ever seen, where in Act Two, you actually go to a different room. And they've set it up where you actually feel like you're at a wedding reception. That was very cool and very, very creative and well done.
Yeah. My guest today is Anthony Wilkinson, actor, director, and playwright of My Big Gay Italian Wedding. American Theater Company is presenting the piece this weekend and again next weekend, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Obviously, as this play took off 5-6 years ago, you know, you're doing New York productions all the time. Meanwhile, the world is changing, or at least the United States is changing.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did that affect the play? The fact that once New York had marriage equality for a couple of years.
Oh, my God. It was.
Did it have an effect on the play?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think people have now become more educated on the topic where they were a little less, knew a lot less. The fact that it becomes, even though in my life, nothing has changed, the show hasn't changed. What happens, I believe, is that when the government says this is okay, then people now start to have the perception that it's okay. Even though, like I said, it doesn't change my opinion. It was always okay as far as I'm concerned. And I think it's great for the community because now, like, parents of gay kids and who are struggling with that kind of topic at home, now it's a little bit of a light bulb because it's like, well, how big? Because if you're not gay, you don't understand why other people are. So, but it is, you know, it's not a choice, which is something I've always spoke about. So you have to ask people, do you want them to be happy? Or do you want them to be miserable? So it does help. It really, I think it just helps put it like a green light for a lot of people. And their perceptions have changed. And they're becoming a little more accepting.
Has it changed the reaction to the play any at all because you don't have this novelty factor as much?
Yes. Yes. I think people now appreciate the comedy more and are less afraid of the topic. You know, and I think, and one of the things that came up last night, which was a very interesting question that they asked me at the Q&A last night, and I didn't even know the answer till it was asked to me. I had to actually say it out loud. But someone had said, would I revise the play now? Because the play was written in 2003. And the topic is about, you know, one of the story points, and again, it's very small and subtle, but he does say, you know, it's not legal here. So we have over the years said, oh, but it's legal in Massachusetts. We can get married in Iowa. We can get married in Vermont, whatever. So we've adapted that. So now we've changed it where it's like, and now it's legal in the whole country. And but what's going to happen is because I'm opening my new show. So the wedding's going to come down for a couple of months. I was going to revise it, but the director here made a very good point to me that this is a period piece because it was written in 03 at a time when it wasn't legal in any states. Right. So to preserve that piece of history, I think I should leave it alone and let it speak for itself, because 20 years from now, when it's been legal now for a long time and people who are of the younger generation are not going to really recall this being such an excitement, they can look back and say, oh, wow, I guess it was a big, you know, I wonder what that was like.
I mean, it's really hard to put us back 12 or 13 years ago, but think about it. You know, I have not seen the play, so I assume the marriage couple kisses, doesn't it?
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
I mean, it was a big deal.
Huge.
I mean, nobody, same-sex kissing on any sort of media or any sort of play or anything was just sort of, that was almost taboo.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Close.
And I remember that when we first started running in 2003, I remember some guy when in the scene when the two guys kissed, he like walked out and he said to the box office guy, he goes, I want my money back. He goes, I don't want to see two guys kiss on stage. He goes, there should be a sign that says that. And the box office manager was like, well, the sign is my big gay Italian wedding. Did you not think two men were going to kiss on stage? And, you know, really it is. I mean, my play is kind of, I mean, it's very G-rated. I mean, it's just, but there's nothing remotely risque about it. But two men do kiss. And I think as time goes on, especially now that you can see it on primetime television, you never saw that before.
Right.
I just started watching some of these new series and I'm like, there's a gay character in every show now.
Right.
And it's like, and they, you will see two men kissing on primetime television, which is incredible. It's like, I think that helps people see that this is just life, you know?
No. But I'm trying to remember the film where that was first depicted, and I just remember that the director said I had him kiss right at the beginning because everybody was going to be saying, when are they going to kiss?
Yeah.
So he did it right at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it's just so amazing how things have changed in 12 years.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you can only just hope to, I will say, seeing the show is opening in Tres Cruces, New Mexico in a couple of weeks. It's opening in near Sagatuck, Michigan. It opened in Fountain City, Wisconsin, Tulsa. There's a bunch of cities Omaha played in for a while. So seeing those cities always is really a great thing, because those are the cities that you would conceive to be the most conservative and have the most issues with the topic. So when I see that they're getting picked up here and they're doing well and people and it's being well received, that's really.
Have you had any protests around the country?
Omaha.
Yeah.
And when they were the first people to license it in 2010. And the director sent me a sign. It was just two people standing, two lonely, miserable people standing there with picket signs saying something horrible. Yeah. And it was something religious. And I just remember thinking to myself, who are these two people and why do they have nothing else to do but to picket and bother these people? And I was like, well, I called her up. I said, well, you go tell those people that Jesus wants them to leave everybody alone. Jesus won't want them banging on anybody's doors. So. So I said, I don't think he, you know, he really is that worked up on it. So I hope he's got better things to worry about. So, you know, so anyway, so it was a little minor protest. But
that's the biggest thing. Yeah.
No, I've had some people in New York every so often, but it's rare.
Yeah.
Now more rare.
Now this has now become almost a franchise now because you know you have the funeral piece. Mm-hmm. Now how did that come about?
My father passed away in 08. Uh-huh. And art imitates life. Uh-huh. So I was with someone for 8 years, and the funeral is a story of, it's very different. It has nothing to do with any kind of politics or political issues. Like gay marriage, which clearly lit a big fire. The funeral really is just the sequel in a gay man's life, which is my character, how as you get older, you lose people. It also deals with holding grudges. And one of the things that I have dealt with in family issues is, and I think, again, all people can relate to this, women, again, I'm loving the new show as well. We're in our third year. And it's about everyone, I think, has a family member who they may not be as close with, or something happened. And in my case, it's my brother, who's also gay. And it's again, of course, it's a laugh out loud comedy. But the topic is basically how it started off as a small fight that manifested over years. And we haven't spoken.
It became a huge blow up.
Right. Yeah. And it took my father to die to put us in the same room together.
Wow.
So, and what I love about this story is that even more people can relate to it. Because the gay topic is really not the main focus. And it doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. It's the same problems. The gay element is what really drives the comedy, but it's not the main threat, you know. So the, and now my new show, which is opening in October, is my big gay midlife crisis. And that really focuses on, and again, I think women will relate to this, you know, when you're starting to approach a certain age and you're still single and your first relationship didn't work out. Maybe the next one will. At what point do I settle? At what point do I not accept the fact that people are just, it talks about the struggles of relationships, how even if you are married, it's not all, you know, peaches and roses every day. It's like, it's very hard to keep up with the marriage. It's very hard to keep it, you know, alive. And of course, I tell this from a gay perspective, which is my own, but I do think a lot of people will connect to it, gay or straight.
Yeah. Yeah. When do you start previews?
October 4th.
Oh, yeah. So it'll open it right around the holidays.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be ready for the holidays.
Anthony, it was a pleasure to meet you, and thanks so much. We look forward to the production.
I thank you very much for having me.
Actor, director, and playwright Anthony Wilkinson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. American Theater Company is presenting his comedy, My Big Gay Italian Wedding, tonight and tomorrow at 8, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, and again next weekend at the American Theater Company Studios at 308 South Lansing Place. For ticket information, visit myticketoffice.com or call the Tulsa PAC box office. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. This past week, Oklahomans lost Red Dirt music pioneer Tom Skinner, who died Sunday at the age of 61. Skinner was a founding force in the Red Dirt music movement, and commentator Barry Friedman has a remembrance.
As many of you know, musician Tom Skinner just died. There have been bios and testimonials all over town, and please read them. And they're all written by people who knew him better than I. Nevertheless, about 10 years ago, actually exactly 10 years ago, I wrote a piece on Tom for Urban Tulsa Weekly and his Wednesday night music jam called, appropriately enough, Tom Skinner's Wednesday Night Science Project. Here's just some of that piece, and if you count Wes Gassaway, Rocky Frisco, J.J. Cale, Marilyn Morris, and now Tom, the piece is now filled with too many ghosts. The band is in the middle of Like a Blind Man, a song about hope and futility, and Tom Skinner on acoustic guitar and lead vocals has his eyes closed. His hair is gray and thick with a beard to match covering most of his face, but you can make out the hint of a smile, as if he's in the middle of some joke only he knows. He looks more like a man who reads utility meters for a living, which he used to do, than a folk musician, or maybe he's what a folk musician is supposed to look like. Hunter Thompson once said, before you know where it is, you have to go past it. Many in the band here tonight not only have gone past it, they've lost years trying to find their way back. It is a diverse, peculiar, and talented group with lives that read like a Nathaniel West short story. Skinner is uncomfortable when you bring it up, but what he was nearly about was Garth Brooks. He and Brooks started together in Stillwater, went to Nashville together, but Tom came back to Oklahoma a few milliseconds before Brooks exploded. Really, other people have made a bigger deal than I have, he told me about his time with Brooks. When I left, it had nothing to do with personalities. It was about my family, which includes a son, Jeremy, now in college. Jeremy used to get in trouble in school and tell people, but my dad played with Garth Brooks, and I'd say, stop telling people that. Then when Tom's not getting enough press, he says, he starts reminding them, hey, I played with Garth Brooks. Joining the band on stage tonight is a flautist. Larry Spears, one of Tom's best friends, sits down to listen. What do you think happens in life makes someone want to play the flute, he asks. Spears is one of those grizzled Tulsa musicians who gets less press than he deserves, throws away more songs than most songwriters in town finish. He and Skinner have an unusual friendship. When Skinner made Urban Tulsa Weekly's top 100 movers and shakers last year, Spears commented on his friend's inclusion and the accompanying blurb that read, Skinner makes every song his own. He's a damn thief is what he is, Spears says, a song-stealing bastard. There are two shows tonight, the one at Boston's and the other at Breakfast. After science is over and the band carts its respective stuff into their 10- and 15-year-old cars and trucks, some of us head to Village Inn, where Skylar, our waitress, awaits. I am only here because I'm married to one of the musicians. This Village Inn gig is invitation only. On this day, like most early Thursday mornings, the talk is about musicians, extraterrestrials, new songs, ex-wives, and Tom's heart attack a few years back. Susan, a vegetarian, gets the Boca Burger. Rocky gets eggs over hard and toast. Amelie orders in painstaking detail, making sure Skylar knows exactly what he wants and that the yolks have to be presented to him a certain way. The other musician, whose name I don't remember, orders ice cream, and Skinner gets the pancakes, extra butter. Skylar rolls her eyes. She's been through this before. She knows to bring the crackers and extra mayo and to make the fries well done. Someone kids Tom about the time Tom, strung out on something or other a million years ago, swore the car had a face. I swear, Skinner says, the knobs were singing to me. I could see their lips move. Rocky, who knows more than is probably healthy, talks about a DVD he wants us all to see that exposes the 9/11 conspiracy and then begins to explain the Illuminati, a movement that began in 18th century Bulgaria and has its links now to George Bush, the Antichrist, lizards, and world domination. Skinner is perplexed. Susan and other musicians listen intently. Tom, who's called Tiny by his friends, then mentions he's traveling to Texas next week to play with Mike McClure and imagines he'll continue his streak. What streak is that, he's asked. The Tiny going down to Texas and not getting laid streak. I'm on week 3. His pancakes come. He's had one heart attack for sure, but thinks there might have been others. The extra butter is the celebration. He's still here, though Susan won't let him order any more. He carries a small tin of nitro tablets on his keychain, just in case, of which he says, if you're having a heart attack, these will save your life. If you're not, they'll give you one blinding headache. Spears jokes that every time Skinner's career starts waning, he has another heart attack. To look at these musicians, you'd think Village Inn in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 3 in the morning is heaven. The sun will soon be up, and nobody's in any rush to leave. There's more talk about a gig at the Blue Door in Oklahoma City, the predilections and prejudice of the musical press here in Tulsa, the various women, ex-wives, girlfriends, and children in their lives who alternately torture and sue them, and why there's a 17-mile-per-hour road sign on a ramp on the Turner Turnpike. Must have been the guy's last day before he quit, someone says. Skinner then pays Susan $25 for some previous gig. Yeah, you stick with me, kid, he says. You'll get the big bucks. Music is full of images, from the songs, from the singers, from the venues. And on Wednesdays, in front of the best band you've never heard of, there's Skinner, this musician who should be as famous as Brooks, this song-stealing bastard with a bruised heart, who sings with his eyes closed, who won't be getting laid for a third consecutive week, reaching deep down into a song about a washed-up minor league baseball player who can't leave the game he loves. It's a hard thing to admit, the song says, but it might be time to quit. Man, I love this game. Tom loved the game. The game loved him back.
Commentator Barry Friedman remembering Red Dirt music pioneer Tom Skinner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Well, my name is Eddie Roberts, and I'm a starting pitcher for the Winston-Salem Warthogs down in the Carolina League. I'm 34 years old now, and my playing days are numbered. I can't control my curveball, and my fastball's lost some speed. I've been knocking around the minors since I got out of high school. You know, I signed my first pro contract on my 17th birthday. From Burlington to Birmingham, on to Charlotte I've traveled. But the White Sox never called, so I stalled in AAA. But I love this game. Man, I love this game. And it's a hard thing to admit, but it might be time to quit. But God, I love this game.